Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I am Jonathan Warren. I am actually the co-associate rector at Church of the Ascension in Oakland and Pittsburgh. I will be teaching a June term class here, so that is my connection to Trinity, aside from being friends with a lot of people who teach here. And it is my privilege to be able to welcome this morning Christina Bieber-Lake to come talk to us about post-humanism and the fight for the soul. This will be session 4 in the Ancient Evangelical Future Conference. Christina is the Clyde S. Kilby Professor of English at Wheaton College. She got her PhD from Emory University. At Wheaton, she teaches classes in contemporary American literature and literary theory. A frequent contributor of essays on fiction, ethics, and film, she's authored several essays on Flannery O'Connor, which endears me to her greatly. My daughter is actually named Flannery, after the illustrious Flannery O'Connor, as well as a monograph on her called The Incarnational Art of Flannery O'Connor. Her most recent book and the winner of the 2014 Aldersgate Prize for Integrative Christian Scholarship is Prophets of the Post-Human, American Fiction, Biotechnology, and the Ethics of Personhood. Please join me in welcoming Christina.
Okay, let's see if I'm working here. Does that sound like we're on? Okay, thank you, Jonathan, and thank you, Joel, for inviting me to this conference. It's a delight to be here. I do feel a little bit, as a lit professor, like a fish out of water, and maybe for some of you, I'm more like the Asian carp that are studying, you know, heading toward the lakes. I hope not. There's a way in which I could have just gotten up here and read Flannery O'Connor's short story, Parker's Back, and then sat down. And so if you don't hear anything else that I say today, I encourage everyone, if you've never read Parker's Back by Flannery O'Connor and you're interested in theological anthropology, please read it. So if even just one or two of you do that, I would be, my work here would be done. Okay. So trust me on that one. All right. Let's see. When I was knee-deep in my research on human enhancement technology, it became clear to me that the futurist Ray Kurzweil was right about one thing. The primary political and philosophical issue of the 21st century will be the definition of who we are. So I decided to put my research to work and lead some of my colleagues in a seminar on the question of what it means to be human. We were a motley crew of scientists, humanists, and theologians. We read Pope John Paul II, Elaine Graham, Gilbert Mylander. We also read Peter Singer, Ronald Bailey, Steven Pinker, as well as some works of fiction that address this issue. We met once a week for a year, and we discussed many, many things. By the end of the time, nobody's surprised, we didn't agree on a single definition of the human person. But we did agree on one thing, that Christian leaders in the church and in the academy must do everything we can to keep one word and its rich concept in play. And that word is soul. So my argument today is that the theological concept of the soul has been under considerable duress since Darwin, and that post-humanism is trying to push it out of our vocabulary altogether. If we allow that to happen, there will be, I think, even more distance between the average person and the teachings of the church, and it will also consign some of the richest teachings of the church fathers, right, to an even greater obscurity. So, to make this argument, I'm going to first spend a little time illustrating the philosophical ramifications of the loss of concepts. Second, I'm going to show how the theological concept of the soul has been under attack in our late modern world. Third, I'm going to give us a glimpse of what the church fathers agreed on about it. And finally, I'm going to argue very briefly that maintaining the concept of mind or consciousness is not enough. So first, losing our concepts. A number of prominent philosophers, including Charles Taylor and Alistair MacIntyre, have been interested in what happens when particular words and their concepts fall out of use in a culture. The question seems to me particularly pertinent in an era in which people get their news through sites called BuzzFeed, and the President of the United States communicates primarily through Twitter. In an essay entitled Losing Your Concepts, Cora Diamond gives the example of the word lust and explains how, in the interest of finding more neutral terms, the word lust is often replaced by the term sexual desire. Now, this is really interesting because I have to add that a couple of weeks after I wrote this paper, Philip Roth died. and it's impossible to talk about Philip Roth without using the word lust. So there was this big uptake in the word lust in the media. Diamond, wishing to be strictly philosophical, does not weigh in on exactly what is lost here, but I'm not a philosopher, and so I will. It is easy to see how replacing lust with sexual desire is an impoverishment. Sexual desire is the larger term, but it's also more abstract. When Jesus admonishes that when a man lusts after a woman in his heart, he's already committed adultery with her, he is talking about a specific kind of sexual desire, the kind that is covetous, the kind that wants to possess and not respect the other. Webster defines lust rather unhelpfully as strong sexual desire. And it is this very weak definition itself in that we see the loss of the concept that concerned Jesus. The less often the word lust is used in our vocabulary, the farther away we get from understanding Jesus' teaching about it. The cultural outcome is predictable. Without an understanding of lust, today's young people, when it comes to relationships with one another, are left with the crude inadequacy of consent laws. I could go on about that. It's a topic that interests me a lot, but that's not my purpose today. My purpose is to show how the uniquely theological concept of the soul is not only dissolving from our language, but is being actively attacked by those who declare that human beings are biological accidents. So, next, posthumanism and the soul. Since Darwin, the use of the word soul has been steadily going downhill. So for fun, I did a quick word search in Google Books. Now, this is only in books, not the web or magazines or what have you. As you can see, there's a peak in the early to mid 19th century, and then you go down and down and down, and then you have a slight uptake here. Notice the nadir is around 1980 when the Kansas City Royals lost to the Philadelphia Phillies in the World Series. Here it is with the concept of the brain overlaid on top of it. Soul has taken over a little bit, but this only goes to 2008. So I think its uptake is due to the events of 2001, 9/11. So, but who knows? This is not a proof of anything. I just give it because I think it's interesting. Now, I believe that our post-human culture wants the word soul to ring in our ears as archaically as a word like chastity or perdition. Allow me to explain why. The best definition, I think, of what it means to be post-human has been provided by literature scholar Kate Hales. Now, Hales argues that we have been post-human since the moment we allowed the Turing test to define what it means for someone to be determined, to be sentient, or even alive. So Alan Turing devised his test in the 1950s. It's used to test artificial intelligence by having a computer in one room and several persons in other rooms, each communicating with the interviewer here, who is a human, right? So he's interviewing the machine and the person. And of course, this is all by text because there's no Cylons. If you could actually have a Cylon, a machine that took a human form, you would do it that way. So it's all obviously by text, okay? So if the human being sort of gets duped into thinking that the computer is a person, then the Turing test has proved that some kind of artificial intelligence exists, right? That you sort of won the Turing test. You don't really win it, but that's kind of what that means. Now, Hales is not saying that this would mean that computers have exceeded human intelligence. She's not even making an argument about artificial intelligence per se. Instead, and I think this is really insightful, she says that the moment we began to think in the terms offered by the Turing test was the moment Western culture became post-human. This is because the test assumes that what makes us identifiably human is something that can be described by information patterns, personality on a page, our ideas, how we present ourselves, how we invent ourselves, not our embodiment, the place of our birth, our location in space and time, any of that. And if that's the case, right, then what we actually do with our bodies doesn't matter at all. And by the way, this is, basic American Gnosticism, right? Our bodies are plastic. We can manipulate them. We can change them. You can have a dragon tongue. You could do whatever you want. I mean, there's just all kinds of crazy stuff out there. Believe me, I've read a lot about it. But our 21st century version is an utterly materialistic techno-Gnosticism. because any possibility for something spiritual going on here, the possibility that human beings have been given souls by their creator, has been emptied out and replaced. And what it has been replaced with is intelligence, right? What it has been replaced with is the brain. Let me give you a brief and very reductive primer on how the idea of the soul has been devalued and replaced by the brain. Since at least the 1970s, sociobiologists like E.O. Wilson take the Darwinian evolutionary paradigm and use it to argue that everything about us can be explained by it, from art to politics to religion. Everything can be explained by an adaptive evolutionary framework. So Daniel Dennett, who is as atheistic as they come, feels empowered to write many books. If you've read any of them, you know what I'm talking about, that belittle believers for thinking that God is real rather than something that we made up. Dennett believes that there's nothing mysterious about our existence that science will not eventually fully account for. This leads him to write what has to be my favorite title of a book of all time, Consciousness Explained. Thus, Dennett can be very certain when he proclaims, let me put the concept, the problem unequivocally. The traditional concept of the soul as an immaterial thinking thing, Descartes' res cogitans, the internal locus in each human body of all suffering and meaning and decisions, both moral and immoral, has been utterly discredited. Science has banished the soul as firmly as it has banished mermaids, unicorns, and perpetual motion machines. Now, Richard Dawkins, another well-known new atheist, is infamously tried on Dr. Persinger's God helmet, okay? Now, in case you're unfamiliar with this experiment, I have embedded here a 5-minute video that's worth watching, and because it's kind of fun in a conference, let's like listen, watch a video. It's hilariously creepy, okay? Dawkins is not in this video, and I'll talk about his experience in a bit. Now, I think I need to come down here and hit the space bar or something to get that going.
I guess I was sort of in a state of fear where I didn't want to turn around and look.
A very friendly, welcoming feeling at one instance.
I was starting to feel very anxious and very cold. The outlines of a human body, almost complete and total panic. Very visual experiences. One of the first ones.
Here at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario, a team is investigating certain common perceptions of the inner mind.
So we'll be taking a baseline recording first.
Mm-hmm. Right now, they're looking at the electromagnetic brain patterns seen in people having the near-death experience.
We're going to compare that.
The research is led by Dr. Michael Persinger.
Basically, at any given time, all experience is due to those portions of the brain that are most metabolically active. If we can simulate that by applying complex, meaningful magnetic fields to the brain, we can also induce those experiences.
This experiment is testing the idea that mystical perceptions and paranormal experiences can be turned on at will, not by hypnosis or shamanic drumming, but by a scientist stimulating nerve activity in the brain. The volunteer sits blindfolded in a soundproof chamber. This sensory deprivation allows the mind to focus on electromagnetic patterns transmitted across the brain through this modified crash helmet.
If you feel anything change with the electrodes?
They're able to simulate the exact brain patterns that occur in near-death experiences.
Is that comfortable?
Dr. Persinger hopes the research will benefit psychotherapy.
We tried to evoke the fragments that compose the near-death experience and other mystical experiences, such as detachment, feelings of moving through a tunnel, hearing voices, the sense of a presence, usually on the left side. Our major thrust is ultimately to apply this to dealing with things such as psychological depression.
After a while, I remember feeling that there was someone else in the room with me, almost looking over my left shoulder. It was all I could do to not turn my head and want to look.
If you stimulate the deep portions of the temporal lobe, So you can get very, very vivid imagery. And the emotional commitment or the emotional sensation that something is profound, real, cosmically real, and personally significant.
It's a male voice, but it's like really, really far away. As if you can just sort of like catch
a tone you can't really hear. You can tell that it's someone talking. You can distinguish that. But you can't make out any kind of words or anything like that.
What we've been doing recently is generating words as magnetic patterns. And even though the person isn't hearing it through their ears, their brain is interpreting it. So they're actually having fragments of experiences as if they're hearing it, when in actual fact they cannot be.
These experiences are so strong, they're utterly real for the person who has them. They can be as profound as a religious conversion, yet we can generate them with a machine. These mind games are beginning to shed their secrets. The scientist becomes the shaman. But where are the limits? What else can people be made to believe?
Well, one thing that's really clear, you can control the person's experiences, and they don't know they're being controlled. That's why this technology is a potentially powerful one and has a two-edge to its sword.
As a tool of science, this technology may bring us valuable new understandings of the obscure depths of the human mind. But there's a dark side. In the wrong hands, could it become an instrument of power, a means of oppression? If we're not careful, will mind games one day become mind control?
Next on TLC, how many...
Well, there you go. Waha! The scientist has become the shaman. Right? For some reason, when this specific clip of Dawkins trying on the helmet, it was taken off YouTube. When he tried it on, he had no reaction whatsoever. Dr. Persinger concluded that his temporal lobes, Dennett's temporal lobes, are different from most people's, which, okay, do with that what you will. But my point here is that the assumption behind all these experiments is that religious experience is located in the brain alone and not in anything that stimulates those regions that can be used to reproduce it. God is not necessary, and neither is the antiquated concept of the soul. Now, Marilyn Robinson has delightfully called Dawkins and Dennett and their ilk parascientists. But it is also the case that many more serious scientists who do work in this area have concluded the same thing. For example, the biologist Lee Silver has written, if asked about the role played by God or spirits in the lives of organisms, nearly every molecular biologist I know from institutions around the world would respond in the same way that the mathematician Laplace did to a similar query for Napoleon about the workings of the universe. Sir, I have no need for that hypothesis. And more to my point, the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio, who is a serious scientist, has written a number of books that are meant for a larger public, including a book called Self Comes to Mind. I've read this book very carefully and interacted with it at length. Here's the main thesis. Countless creatures for millions of years have had active minds happening in their brains, but only after those brains developed a protagonist capable of bearing witness did consciousness begin in the strict sense, and only after those brains developed language did it become widely known that minds did exist. The witness is the something extra that reveals the presence of implicit brain events we call mental. Understanding how the brain produces that something extra, the protagonist we carry around and call self or me or I, is an important goal of the neurobiology of consciousness. Do you wonder where the self resides? Is it in your head or between your sides? And who will be the one who will decide its true location? Damasio has decided for you. It's in your brain, which has produced your sense of self, which is fundamentally, by the way, an illusion. Your sense of self is an illusion produced by your brain. Marcus Gabriel, in his book, I Am Not a Brain, calls this neurocentrism. Neurocentrism very simply insists that the self is a brain. I'm going to go even farther than Gabriel and say that what we have here is a kind of neuromonism. According to the scientific naturalism of our day, the brain is the principle that explains everything that matters in our culture, because by it and in it and through it, we invented God, and we alone give our lives whatever meaning they have. Neuromonism. Now, it's not accidental that my term neuromonism sounds a little bit like neutral monism, a term that can be used to describe the teaching of William James. In 1904, James argued for pure experience over the notion of consciousness as an entity. I believe that consciousness, when once it is evaporated to this a state of pure death, is on the point of disappearing altogether. It is the name of a non-entity and has no right to a place among first principles. Those who still cling to it are clinging to a mere echo, the faint rumor left behind by the disappearing soul upon the air of philosophy. Now, James goes on to argue that consciousness is not a thing but a function, a product of relations between subject and object. Now, to be clear, I think he's right about that. But we should also recognize that from here, when we so gleefully abandon the notion of a God-given soul, is a short step to saying that consciousness is merely a product and function of the brain in a certain state. And indeed, that is a step that has been taken by the discipline of psychology after James, though I doubt James himself would approve. Now, lest we think that this move to what I'm calling neuromonism was born in the 20th century, we see that Emily Dickinson, I am a literature scholar after all, was ahead of her time with her 1862 poem, The Brain is Wider Than the Sky. The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease, and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb, as sponges, buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for heft them pound for pound, and they will differ, if they do, as syllable from sound. I wish we had time to talk about that. But I want to move on to the church fathers on the soul. My point in raising these examples is not, God forbid, to make a philosophical argument about the nature of consciousness, nor is it to arm us up for the culture wars, but to get us to consider what we will lose if the concept of the soul is replaced by the brain, consciousness, DNA, these physical things. What we will lose is significant contact with the word that in one English translation of the Bible, the ESV, is used 271 times, 43 of which are in the New Testament. We will not be able to understand what Mary meant when she says, "My soul magnifies the Lord." We will not be able to follow the command of Jesus when he quotes Deuteronomy, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all of your mind." This makes no sense if the soul is not something different from one's heart or mind or brain. And incidentally, according to Malcolm Jeeves, and I haven't verified this, the word brain doesn't even appear in the Bible at all. Now, I'm not a biblical scholar, Esau, and I understand that the Hebrew word for soul, nefesh, is not just used for human beings and is closer to the idea of the word of breath, the idea of breath in all living things. By the time we get to the New Testament, the Greek word psuche is arguably used differently and is in a complex relationship with the word pneuma, or spirit. Regardless, it is clear that in English, the word soul is most often used to denote that distinctive part of us that lives on, and that in English, the word spirit has been more emptied out. It's been emptied out in our culture by the likes of Oprah. And this, you can ask my husband, right? Spirit. Just ask him for his imitation of Oprah. It's become, you know, more of a Gnostic kind of thing, spirit. So instead of making a biblical argument, I'm going to generalize a little bit about what the church fathers taught about the soul, about where it was located, what it is, where it came from. Now, we should not be surprised to discover that there is a wide range of opinions related to this classic mind-body problem, and I'm not going to reiterate those. Suffice it to say that some of them look a little closer to the classical dualism variety of the separable soul, and others look closer to what could be called non-reductive physicalism, right? A lot depends on the context, who they're responding to, of the church father is responding to. So what I'm going to do instead is to highlight what the father's treatment of the soul have in common, because these are precisely the ideas that are fading from our contemporary language. And Joel, I'd like to thank you for inviting, because I finally got to read all of Against Heresies because of this. And it was a delightful slog. The three main arguments they all make about the soul, the ones that I read, is that it's created by God. And second, it represents our uniqueness, that because of the incarnation and the final resurrection, requires both body and soul to properly consider. And third, it will, for good reason, remain a mystery until the end. You know, the connection between the body and the soul. So first, created by God. The most important thing that the fathers insist on when it comes to the soul is that it's created by God. This was to clearly distinguish the Christian approach from the Platonic, both in the fact of the soul's birth and in the soul's need for a simultaneously created body. Tertullian, for when we acknowledge that the soul originates in the breath of God, it follows that we attribute a beginning to it. This Plato indeed refuses to assign to it, for he will have the soul to be unborn and unmade. We, however, from the very fact of its having had a beginning, as well as from the nature thereof, teach that it had both birth and creation. Now, I don't have time to go into the places here, but they're all talking about simultaneous creation. So Tertullian and Irenaeus insist that body and soul were created simultaneously. So as Tertullian put it, not a moment's interval occurs in their conception so that a prior place can be assigned to either. Happens at the same time. Second, represents this uniqueness, right? The simultaneous creation is very important, for it insists that you don't really have one without the other, as if the soul came first and God built a body around it, or as if God took a lifeless body and stuck a soul into it. In all the church fathers that I have read, when it comes to the relationship between body and soul, I see two areas of agreement. First, the soul is clearly the superior thing, like a kind of organizing principle, because the soul is that place where each person remains in a continuity. They were very aware that your body's atoms or molecules are changing all the time, even though they didn't have the scientific language for that. But second, that continuity is meaningless without a recognizable body that will in some way be returned to us, new and improved, in the resurrection, the final resurrection. A fascinating thing I discovered is that when it comes to biblical evidence for this unity, Tertullian, Gregory of Nyssa, and Irenaeus all rely on the passage in Luke 16 where the rich man dies and goes to Hades and pleads with Abraham and Lazarus from there. He's like, please put a drop of water on my tongue. They're like, how could he ask for a drop of water on his tongue if he didn't have a body? You know, they all use that for this evidence of a bodied resurrection. When it comes to finding a metaphor for the relationship between body and soul, Irenaeus and Gregory of Nyssa both turn to the example of a painter. Irenaeus says the soul is possessed of the reason of an artist. Now, he says that the artist has to rely on the slower instruments of expression, paintbrush, paints, canvas. He has to rely on that in order to do anything. But the fact that the artist is more important than the paintbrush and his tools and other tools doesn't mean that he can do without these tools and still be called an artist. The soul has to have the body to be expressed in. Now, 100 years after that, Gregory of Nyssa borrows from that, but he's even less dualistic, okay? The soul, he argues, is like the art of the painter. Now, stay with me for a while. This is a little abstract, but really interesting. The soul is like the art of the painter, and the body's atoms are like its colors and their arrangement in the paint. Now, Gregory of Nyssa does this in order to say that the painter, who is like God working through the soul, it's a little unclear, but stay with me, remembers that the soul, God, through the soul, remembers which colors he used when and how he mixed them up. So that there's a kind of continuity that exists even if the work of art was destroyed or burned up, right? There's this big worry about what would happen if your body was disintegrated. And Gregory of Nyssa is saying that your soul would actually remember your atoms and recollect them. Okay? So the soul has a power of recognition that will come into play in the final resurrection when it remembers our Adam and collects them, atoms and collects them. This is some weird stuff, right? And the power of recognition, and I'd like to talk about this, it sounds to me a little bit like DNA, which is kind of cool to think about. We can maybe explore that a little bit. But what interests me is the insistence in this metaphor. If the soul is like the work of art itself, it is meaningless to say that it can exist apart from the body, right? The work of art does not exist as an abstract image, as if it's somehow extractable from the paint that gives the work of art its expression. That's a meaningless thing. So for Gregory, the concept of a unique soul has no meaning without a unique body that contains its life. And this sets up Gregory to make up some wonderfully inspiring arguments. And I just wanted to give you some bits of text so that you can be inspired by this church father. This seems to be part of the point of this conference, right? This is so good. You will behold this bodily envelopment, which is now dissolved in death, woven again out of the same atoms, not indeed into this organization with its gross and heavy texture, but with its threads worked up into something more subtle and ethereal. So that you will not only have near you that which you love, but it will be restored to you with a brighter and more entrancing beauty. And Gregory, I think, wisely switches to a different metaphor, and he chooses the seed, actually, from our sermon this morning, provided by Jesus when he says, unless a grain falls to the ground and dies, it remains by itself alone, and then developed by Paul, right, when the body that will be sown corruptible will be raised incorruptible. So he switches to that metaphor. And here's a longer text, but this is just so good, so forgive me. Whence do seeds get the bodies that spring up from them? What precedes this springing up? Is it not a death that precedes? At least if the dissolution of a compacted whole is a death. For indeed it cannot be supposed that the seed would spring up into a shoot unless it had been dissolved in the soul, and so became spongy and porous to such an extent as to mingle its own qualities with the adjacent moisture of the soil, and thus becomes transformed into a root and shoot, not stopping even there, but changing again into the stalk with its intervening knee joints that gird it up so like many clasps to enable it to carry with figure erect the ear with its load of grain. Where then were all these things belonging to the grain before its dissolution in the soil? And yet this result sprang from that grain. If that grain had not existed first, the ear would not have arisen. Just then, as the body of the ear comes to light out of the seed, God's artistic touch of power producing it all out of that single thing, and just as it is neither entirely the same thing as the seed, nor something entirely altogether different, so by these miracles performed on seeds, you may now interpret the mystery of the resurrection. The divine power in the superabundance of omnipotence does not only restore you that body once dissolved, but makes great and splendid additions to it, whereby the human being is furnished in a manner still more magnificent. Isn't that great? So for Gregory, the key is that, like the seed that has a body but is not its final body, but somehow contains it, right? Our bodies here are fully physical but are not perfected or completed until death. The seed's seediness, if you will, dissolves into the ground, and the seed's plantness is raised by God's power and design out of it. This is a remarkably coherent argument for bodily continuity that accommodates miraculous bodily changes in the resurrection. But this metaphor, too, has its limits, and you can see Gregory straining against these limits, for as human beings are more unique and different from one another than our seeds, right? But the metaphor helps us to understand that it's the same continuity and discontinuity between our embodied lives here and in the resurrection. It's the same as in a tiny mustard seed that grows into a plant that nobody would have been able to predict if they hadn't seen that miracle unfold over and over and over again. Now, all of the church fathers allow that this is very difficult to describe. And the reason for this is that the connection of body and soul is a very deep mystery. The church fathers understand the limits of their knowledge and would never write a book called The Soul Explained. Instead, they rely on scriptural revelation to agree together that the soul is our unique person, created by God, enduring, and that it will be raised. incorruptible. The body. The dream of transhumanists, say of Ray Kurzweil, that the information patterns of our brains can be downloaded into a computer or reanimated in a different body would be utterly incoherent to the church fathers. Here is St. Augustine on the soul and its origins. Wherefore I too on my side say concerning my soul, I have no certain knowledge how it came into my body, for it was not I who gave it to myself. That's the key. He who gave it to me knows whether he imparted it to me from my father or created it afresh for me as he did for the first man. But even I shall know when he himself shall teach me in his own good time. Now, however, I do not know, nor am I ashamed like him to confess my ignorance of what I know not. And this is a guy who's written thousands of pages, right? Would that we would all follow his lead. This is not a God of the gaps argument, but a genuine mystery that we are in danger of losing if we forget that our souls are given to us by God, not the product of some biological accident. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that the word soul has some kind of magical shamanistic power to defend the existence of God. I'm also not saying that philosophers and other academics should use it all the time like some kind of bludgeon. For example, in my own scholarship, especially when I'm making ethical arguments, I have found that the best term that we can use to describe the human being as made in the image of God is person. Now, this is especially useful to use as opposed to the term individual. But it's also true that the theological content of the word person is being drained away, especially by folk like Peter Singer, who co-opts it to stand for certain traits whereby a person can be granted or denied personhood. And that's why Gills doesn't like the word personhood, because you'll have traits that can be granted or denied that way. Human beings in this view have neither inherent dignity nor sanctity, and so parents have the right to kill an infant that does not meet the minimum criteria of personhood, according to Singer. Now, I still strongly believe that the battle over the word person is worth fighting, and I have found Robert Spemann's work to be indispensable in this area, and I would recommend that. What I'm saying is that this argument for the dignity of each person is going to be harder and harder to make if we lose the concept of the soul. Would Mary be saying the same thing if she said, "My person magnifies the Lord"? Now, absence of soul, my last point. I'm just going to touch on this very briefly. The fact that it is essential to keep the unique theological content of the word soul can be seen by the limitations of other would-be substitutes like mind or consciousness. I think Marilynne Robinson, just to use an example, is doing essential work in her book, Absence of Mind, where she argues that parascientists that she talks about are ignoring thousands of years of thinking about what it means to be a person who has a mind when they just say we have brains. She's got this great section where she presses on the way that the story of Phineas Gage has been abused to assume that our uniqueness is merely a product of the brain. Now, those of you unfamiliar with the story of Phineas Gage, 19th century guy who was working on a railroad and got an iron spike shoved up through his brain, survived, conscious, but it completely changed his personality. So this is used by brain scientists all the time to say everything about your personality is located in the brain. And Robinson says this, "I trouble the dust of poor Phineas Gage only to make the point that in these recountings of his afflictions, there is no sense at all that he was a human being who thought and felt, a man with a singular and terrible fate. In the absence of an acknowledgement of his subjectivity, his reaction to this disaster is treated as indicating damage to the cerebral machinery, not to his prospects or his faith or his self-love. He's more than his brain." Robinson rightly keys in on Gage's subjectivity, his mind, his consciousness, his self. From studying her work, it has become clear to me that she thinks what makes us human beings, and I just articulated this at Wheaton a little bit ago, that what makes us human beings, what makes us special, is exactly this self-consciousness. It's chiefly our minds that reveal our humanity. And of course, I think there's something very important about that, and I've drawn on her ideas quite liberally in my own work. But what drops out of view even for her is the idea of Gage's soul, the fact of his uniqueness owing to his having been made as a person in the image of God. The reason why Robinson's approach is not enough is that the idea of self, mind, and consciousness, all of that can be co-opted by sociobiologists as illusions produced by the brain. That can still be co-opted. And starting from the mind alone, it's impossible to disprove that claim. In conclusion, let me say that I'm not trying to pick on this great novelist. I love her. What I want us to be able to ask one another is, how is your soul? And I want us to be able to ask each other that with all the rich hope of eternity that this word contains. There is a danger in putting all of our eggs in the mind or consciousness basket. Alas, we cannot work it all out up here. With our intelligence thus thoroughly frustrated, as the Apostle Paul said it must be, we have to return to Revelation. God made us out of dust, breathed life into us, gave us each a unique and enduring soul, and enjoined us to love God with all of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. That was awesome. Before we call the panelists up, we have just a few minutes. If you have any questions for clarification, we'll have time for discussion later. But if anyone has any questions for clarification, there's just a few minutes to ask those. You want to come up to the mic? You want to come up to the mic?
Hi. I was wondering if you could clarify the distinction between posthumanism and transhumanism. Are those terms more or less synonymous?
They're more or less synonymous. Posthumanism is just a broader term. Transhumanists are people who are deliberately trying to make themselves better than well and live forever. So it's kind of like a subset of a posthuman viewpoint.
Hi. Have you looked into the early history of the English use of that word, of the meanings of the word soul?
I have not. I did not get to be able to do that for this. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Just curious if you could quickly summarize your understanding of the difference between brain and soul.
Between what?
The brain and the soul.
Well,
I know that's,
yeah,
but just to,
you know, actually I welcome that comment because it helps me to be more clear. I think that the way that the church fathers use the word soul doesn't make sense without the body along with it. And so that even if there is, and also doesn't make sense unless it's given by a greater intelligence, so that it can't just be produced by the brain. Right, so the word soul has that idea of being given by God, connected to it, and ultimately connected to the body and irrevocably, not just produced by the brain. You know, because if you think it all comes down to your brain and your body doesn't matter at all, then any DNA or other issues that are associated with that kind of get thrown away too, which is something that's interesting. But anyway, does that make sense? It's not easy to talk about it.
I guess one of the issues I've read a lot about is kind of brain enhancements through computer chips and all that. And how does this play into your research and thoughts?
Well, the book that I wrote, Prophets of the Posthuman, is dedicated to enhancement technology. I don't do a lot with brain enhancement technology per se, but that would be included in that definition of enhancement technology, trying to make yourself better than you, the body you've been given.
Let me call Mark Cortez and Gilbert Mylander up for panel discussion. Dr. Cortez, I'll give you the first question.
Well, Christina, thank you for that. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you. I have a little fun.
Particularly enjoyed kind of dwelling in some of those longer quotations and the language that they used.
And I thought that would be a good thing.
And I do love, so I've talked in a couple of my papers about the power of images that kind of shape and form us and whatnot. And so you've got us thinking about the power of words and how they can convey that very same kind of power. Yes. I do want to kind of, and this may be piggybacking a little bit on that last question, to think a little bit about where your argument's going. So I've heard people make similar arguments about the shift from soul language to self language.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
With their worry being that soul, at least as we typically use the words, soul is inherently a theological term,
yeah,
and self is generally a secular term.
Yep.
And so in that particular argument, they're actually not making any real kind of strong claim about like the ontology of the human person, what comprises us. They just want to, us to recognize that the way that we use our language about the human person can locate conversations in particular ways, and the soul locates the conversation in this kind of rich theological framework, and self locates the conversation in a largely kind of secularized vision.
Exactly.
Is that kind of that kind of linguistic conceptual move really what you want us to be thinking about more than what are the parts that make up the person and how do those parts interact? Is yours more a linguistic conceptual argument?
Yes, that's yes. For this particular paper, it's not to say that I'm not interested in the other issues, but for this particular paper, I'm worried about losing that ground, that the soul at least lets us ask the question, are we here some other way than by an accident, right? Whereas self, it just can be co-opted to say, well, you know, that's just part of what your brain produces, this like the Damasio quote. So yeah, I'm making a linguistic argument primarily. Because, you know, if it becomes an archaic word like perdition, people will just laugh at you when you use it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's part of what I'm saying.
Okay, good. If that's the case, then I'm wondering how you would respond to somebody who said that soul language not only locates the conversation theologically, but at least for many people in Western society, it also locates the conversation in the context of particular philosophical commitments,
yes,
often really strong forms of substance dualism.
Yes. Yes.
So that soul language might be doing not just the things that you want it to do, but maybe a whole bunch of things that you don't want it to do.
I totally agree.
And so there are people now that I know will argue that soul language is actually irretrievable because of all of this baggage that it brings along with it.
Yep.
And so they actually rather intentionally want to shift to, you briefly mentioned person language, mm-hmm, which they'll say is also robustly theological, so it doesn't have the self problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated in our society because of what we've done with person language, but they want to kind of find some other language that can still be robustly theological and doesn't carry that baggage.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, it carries other baggage.
Yeah.
But yeah. So what do we do with all that?
Oh, you know, yeah. I totally agree. And I've been thinking about those issues myself, and I've been trying to think, would person be an adequate substitute for it? And I think spirit is a particularly inadequate substitute because it's so dualistic. It's so disembodied, right? And soul still has some of that embodied part to it. But person, yeah, I mean, a person is a uniqueness and irreplaceability, like we were talking about yesterday. And I do like the word person. And as I said, I use that in my own arguments when I'm making arguments to anybody who might actually outside of this small circle of people read what I write. I use the word person, right? And there's a reason for that. So this argument is, again, not for us as scholars as much as it is for you know, church leaders. But you know, I recognize that, yeah, there's a lot of baggage with it.
Christina, this I think is going to, in a certain sense, come at a similar problem, but from a different angle. But let me just start with a couple Bible passages I just roamed around. In Exodus chapter 1, and these are King James translations, 70 souls from Jacob's family went down to Egypt. That's Nephesh. In 1 Peter, 8 souls were saved in Noah's Ark. That's Psyche. If you look at more recent translations, your ESV, RSV, NEB, none of them use soul. They use person, creature, various kinds of things. And I found myself wondering whether you're worried about the loss of the concept of soul or the word soul. A concept can be carried by various words. And it seemed to me that at different places you seem more worried about the word, and at other places you seem more worried about the concept. So, for instance, you said, would Mary be saying the same, would we hear Mary saying the same thing if she said, my person magnifies the Lord? I thought that was too easy. That one's got such a long liturgical history.
What do you expect? I wanted to go for the low-lying fruit for this crowd.
But lots of other passages I don't think we'd hear. And I think if we took a word that has a lot of resonance in the Bible, like heart, and Mary said, my heart magnifies the Lord, we might not necessarily feel the sense of loss. I mean, person is kind of abstract in some ways, a lot of times. So is it the concept or, is it the word, that you're worried about? And if it's the word, then I think we come to the point Mark raised. The word may carry conceptual overtones that, you wish to disavow, but if I may just note that you yourself fell into on one occasion when you said that in English the word soul is most often used to denote that distinctive part of us that lives on, which seemed to be lives on bodiless, apart from the body in the language. I think we need to think about whether we're supposed to worry about the word and reclaim it, or whether we need to try to ask ourselves, what do we actually mean? What did that word actually mean? What was the concept at work? And how best can we continue to sustain that concept? Now, that was kind of a long thing, but just what would you say about that?
I would say the concept is my main concern. And that's why I started with that piece about Cora Diamond talking about the concept that's behind lust and how, sexual desire doesn't cut it as a replacement term for the concept of lust, right? So they're necessarily joined together to say, if I believe that the word soul has the concept that I want to protect with it that can't be transferred onto something else, then I'm going to argue for the word soul, right? The concept is the main thing. I just happen to think that the word soul still carries with it something that person does not, I guess is what I'm trying to...
But if you think about it, your argument actually suggested that the transhumanists lose the body every bit as much as the soul. And therefore, I mean, I think the worry is larger, much larger.
Yeah, yes, and that's why I spent that time talking about the church fathers. God forbid I'm confusing the church fathers with the transhumanists. The church fathers are so insistent that soul is at the same time as body, so that they're not intelligible one without the other. Right, so that's what recognizing what you're saying, Mark, that it's not always used that way, I can't deny. But I think the more robust meaning of the word soul is that it's connected with the body in a way that's unintelligible otherwise, like as a separable kind of thing. Now, whether soul can do that work or not is another issue.
The transhumanists do not want to be at the mercy of the body.
No, right, at all.
I mean, they don't want to be needy in that sense.
Exactly.
The neediness that's built into being
an organism. That's why I think it's a response to transhumanism, because you see, you can't take that, it's not in your brain. You can't take that consciousness, the information patterns, and put it in some other kind of body and have it be you. Right? So that's why I'm trying to find a word that means both body and spirit, whatever, together, is who you are. And person is the best substitute that I can think of, but it still falls into that accidental creation idea that I could have been just, a biological accident. The emergent consciousness idea that we evolved into persons. We weren't persons to begin with. We were apes and we were the different species kind of thing. And then we had this protagonist that was birthed and then we became persons. That's what I'm trying to avoid. But yeah, I want the full-bodied soul. I want the full-bodied soul. And this is deliberately against the transhumanist kind of way of thinking about the self. It's also just this, that as if you have a right to make it into whatever you want because the part that's given isn't important, right? So I'm arguing for about the soul as being given. But maybe that's not convincing. That's fine. I could go with person.
May I try one more?
Sure.
Angle. Yeah. I mean, maybe what we need is not to recapture the word or even exactly the concept of soul, but a sense of human neediness.
Oh, yes. And givenness. Can we say that?
It's okay, but it's neediness. It's the Augustinian in me that wants neediness. Neediness. I copied down a favorite passage of mine here. It's from literature, so I thought
Excellent.
It'd be okay. Where a character in Wallace Stegner's The Spectator Bird says, a reasonably endowed, reasonably well-intentioned man can walk through the world's great kitchen from end to end and arrive at the back door hungry. And I think, see, if you think of the transhumanists as wanting to be in control and not wanting to be needy, we've got a stake in neediness. That's what creatures are. They're needy. And I don't much care whether we use soul language to get at that or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. I think Hannah Arendt has a great point when she talks about natality as really being important, because part of the transhumanists seem to forget that human beings spend most of their life just completely dependent on other people, you know, their early life, completely dependent on other people, as we all know, and longer than any other animal species that we have that dependency on other people, our mother or whatever. And she thinks that's really important philosophical and theological concept. And same with our deaths. And I wanted to talk about death yesterday, and I forgot to ask you about that, because death is also, you know, a part of that being reminded.
But you can't start asking me questions now.
That's right. Missed my chance.
So if I may ask a question to all three of you. So there seems to have been some implicit denials, disavowals of substance dualism in all three of your comments.
Mine was a question.
It was a question, but it seemed to be phrased in such a way as to suggest a negative answer towards
because
substance
dualism.
Because I
know dualism. Where she's coming.
Fair enough. But I do wonder what you do with the question about the subsistence of the soul post-mortem pre-resurrection. So you focused on the post-resurrection reintegration of the body in a glorified state. But there was no mention of what happens in the intervening period. So
yes.
What is the perspective that each of you bear with regard to that question? But
the
also
intermediate state,
yes. Correct? Yep. And how does the language of soul impact that?
I'll let you start, Gil.
And I approve. It skipped right over me.
Well, I do think that any strong dualism just doesn't work for a lot of reasons. My starting point is to say we should not think of the human being as whatever these parts are. Even parts language is no good, but we shouldn't think of the human being as like a horse and rider, where you could shoot the horse out from under and the rider survives, is fine. Human beings like a centaur, and you can't separate those parts. The first thing to say about the post-mortem question is I sometimes think we're coming at it worrying about the wrong thing. The first question we ought to be worrying about is, why is it that so few Christians today, if we really examine what they think, have any reason to hope for the resurrection from the dead? Because they think everybody's already got more or less everything that God promises, apart from happy reunions with loved ones. There's really nothing to wait. I mean, that's the first problem. We've lost the central Christian affirmation in our consciousness a lot of times. So I would start there. That still doesn't answer your question. What I usually say is that, I talked yesterday that my language for getting at what Christina's worried about is that kind of inwardness that distances us from ourselves in some way. There is a little too much in the Bible and the history of the church just to get rid of it, I think, in the post-mortem state. All I've got to say about it is the dead are dead in Christ, who is the living one. And whatever that means, that they're dead in one who lives, I don't know. I can't say more than that. But that's where they are. As I said yesterday, we have all this language in our Eucharistic liturgy that seems to suggest we're somehow participating with them, so they must be doing something. But I really think that to make that the central question is to be complicit in our general loss of hope for the bodily resurrection.
I have, when answering this question, I often describe myself, when people force me to associate with a label, my label for myself is deeply unhappy and dissatisfied dualist.
That's a good one.
Yeah. It's because almost everything about my theology of the human person pushes in the direction of physicalism, like the inseparability of myself from my body. And I actually confuse people regularly when they hear me talk about what it means to be human, because they generally end up assuming that I'm some form of Christian physicalist, because I actually think that Christians should sound like physicalists most of the time. Like, we should sound like the body fundamentally is inseparable to who we are and all that we do, so that when we talk about spiritual formation and discipleship and worship and all of these kinds of things, we talk about them in fully embodied ways that should have people thinking we're physicalists. And then we get that, what for me is that one question, that we do have biblical texts that talk about the human person is continuing to exist in some way between death and resurrection in ways where we do seem to be doing stuff. And when I hear those who actually are Christian physicalists try to handle those texts, I just find myself unconvinced. Mm-hmm. So I have to have some vision of the human person that can make sense of that kind of language. And then I kind of go with some of the early fathers. I mentioned how Irenaeus does this, where he has the soul continuing to exist in the intermediate state, but in a way where the soul is continually shaped by the reality of the body. So it's not as though, it's certainly not a good state, right? It's a truncated, tragic state. Mm-hmm. But it's also not as though the body doesn't matter for the existence of the soul in that state. Mm-hmm. The body actually still matters, continues to shape the identity of the soul. Which is why, when they use the language of the resurrection, it is that kind of reunion, because the
recollection.
Yeah, it's the soul still has the identity provided by the body, and so it's coming back into what it's supposed to be, even though there's an advance along the way. Mm-hmm. But I agree that I think if we let that be our paradigm question for the human person, that then drives the way that we talk about the human person, we've got the conversation flipped around, because everything else goes towards so much of a more embodied, holistic sense of the person.
That's an excellent answer, and I love saying that you're a dissatisfied and disgruntled dualist, because that's been something about this issue has been so frustrating to me, because I had the opportunity to take the Wheaton's Theological Anthropology course when it was taught by Henri Blochet. And so I listened and took all these notes, and then I came up, and this is before I wrote my book, and I said, so for you, why are you, this dualist? Why is this so important that this is a separable thing? And he said, biblical evidence for the intermediate state. That was his answer. And I, for whatever reason, just couldn't really land on that myself. But every time I read an argument one way, I kind of change my mind. So one day I'll be a separable, like a C. Stephen Evans, and then the next day I'll be a non-reductive physicalist. And I can't decide. So what I do with the intermediate state, because I want to keep the body, and it's the essential nature of the body, I always think of that in terms of a different time, like the time doesn't exist in that place in the same way. That maybe is just a cop-out by me, but that's the way that I think about that.
So in theology, time usually is a cop-out, so that works.
Okay. I'll take it. I'm a literature scholar.
It's not time so much as the relationship between time and eternity.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Now, Maximus the Confessor develops the Irenaean argument in some helpful ways, too. We talk about the ways in which the body imprints the soul and sort of names it and marks it eternally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some mediating positions beyond the kind of extremes. Another kind of follow-up question for all of you is just to kind of take a different tack. When thinking about the transhumanists, it seems like there's a fundamental ambiguity in the way that they construct the argument, right? So they are completely reductive materialists. They locate the sense of consciousness as a kind of epiphenomenon in the brain, and yet it is a strongly agential conception of the self, even though it's epiphenomenal. And then it seems that the body is a kind of mass, an inert mass that can be reshaped and rewoven according to these neurological patterns. And yet we know from other forms of, you know, epidemiology and so forth, that the different systems of the body have profound neurological effects, so that to manipulate one of them is to manipulate that central neurological core. So I'm wondering if you guys could all talk maybe a little bit about that and unpack the systematic ambiguities of that position and also just kind of address them. How would we approach a conversation with someone who happens to be a post or transhumanist?
Well, there are Christian transhumanists, mm-hmm. Who I met a few of them when I was at Samford for the transhumanist conference. And I think that that what you just said about the sort of interrelatability of body systems is so much more complex than they would like to believe, that you just have to kind of keep pushing on that and just say, you know, what makes you think that this brain and its first of all, the brain is super complicated. Okay, so even if we get something that looks like AI, for that AI to actually carry your own consciousness, your own memories or whatever in it, that is like just oogles of complexity right there. So, and this is why there's some interesting things going on in films like Ex Machina or whatever. I write about these kind of films all the time in artificial intelligence, because there is this kind of leap that is always made, right, that I really hate, and that fuels the transhumanist energy as if the body doesn't matter at all. And the leap is this, like, you can get somebody to pass the Turing test and there's a machine that talks to you like in Ex Machina, and then all of a sudden, it decides it's captive. You know, it just decides, I'm captive here. I need to get out. Well, if you don't program it to decide that, how is it going to decide that? You know, and so those kind of facile moves make it harder for us to realize, no, the body is a whole system that has made you who you are with your memories and everything else, and you can't just separate the brain out.
Yeah, I mean, so lots of philosophers have engaged in kind of thought experiments with the brain in the vat that, yes, I've always found just kind of, I mean, I like weird thought experiments. I have no objections to those at all. But the idea that the brain can kind of continue to produce identity independently of broader embodied systems, I've always found to
the
be...
The story Donovan's brain.
Yeah, it's a weird way, even if you're even if you're a transhumanist, it's a weird way to understand how the brain works, right? As though you could pull it out of the body and it's still going to do all of the important kinds of things that it's supposed to do. I do wonder, though, I'm going to be, a bit of a devil's advocate here just to tease out some conversations. So if this is still being recorded, I am not a post-humanist. Yeah, but I do think, okay, so first, I want to encourage us to be a little bit careful using the word Gnostic when talking about posthumanism, partly because I know some posthumanists that simply wouldn't qualify, right, people who are Christians who are teasing this out, partly because the posthumanists themselves don't actually talk as though materiality itself is fundamentally problematic, right? They just think that the body is, let me not even say the body, the embodiment is a broader concept. Mm-hmm. And so that human persons can be embodied in a variety of kinds of systems. Mm-hmm. You don't actually see them trying to cast a vision where human consciousness like arrives at this fully idealized state completely independent of materiality.
That's a good one.
But if that's the case, if they actually are continuing to conceive of the human person as being embodied in some kind of material system, and then they're just pressing us to think that maybe the kinds of material systems in which human persons can be embodied are more transcendent and diverse than we anticipate, mm-hmm. then I think they have a legitimate question to ask us about the resurrection. And because we use the resurrection, I mean, when I hear us talk about the resurrection a lot of times, we say, well, we're going to have a body, but we don't know what it will be. Mm-hmm. Right? Or we read the early fathers when they talk about the resurrection, they're real big on, yes, you will have a body. And then like Gregory of Nyssa, when he talks about the transformation of the human body in the resurrection, I'm like, okay, I'm not sure that I know what we're talking about anymore, because you have the human body taking on characteristics that I just don't associate with bodies. So it's this really transcendent, transformative vision. But even us, like if we're going to say we will be resurrected, but we don't know for sure what that will be, we are also saying that we think it's possible for our human persons to be embodied in a kind of materiality that completely transcends what we currently think of as bodies. And if I'm a post-humanist, I'm just going, yeah, that's what I'm saying too. So there.
Yeah.
What do we think about that?
Well, I'm not sure how much I have to add, but I have the sort of, maybe I'm wrong, I have the sort of simple idea that actually what the trans, I don't know about the category materiality, but what the transhumanists don't want is organic life, because organic life runs down. And so whatever it is that they're desiring, and it may be material in some sense, but not organic. I mean, organisms sustain themselves through metabolic exchanges with the environment, and that doesn't last forever, alas, as some of us know better than others. So I think that's what they're finally aiming for, and that's what I meant when I said it. That it's the body they have a problem with. It's the body as organism. And that they do want to, I mean, at least the kind of cutting edge ones, or that they do want to leave behind. And whatever exactly we mean by the resurrected body or the glorified body or whatever, in some sense, it's still supposed to be organism, I think. But although in some sense is fudge word.
It's a problem. I think in order to address Mark's question, I have to ask you another question, which is, namely, how are we supposed to talk about embodiment and giftedness? So, I mean, you alluded to it briefly, but the way that you've structured the point is that, well, we don't know what the resurrection body looks like, and it's going to be different than the one that we have. We don't know quite what it is, and so, in other words, our organism will be manipulated in some way. But it's not us that's doing the manipulation, right? There's a giftedness to the bestowment of the bestowal of the resurrection body that is not technologically conferred. And it seems like we're in the territory now which Oliver O'Donovan discussed in the 80s in Begotten or Made, right? That we yes. confused what is received, what is natural, with artifice, with yes. what is made. Yes. And that confusion creates fundamental aporias for us. So yes. maybe talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, so let me again be the devil's advocate. For the other word I'd like us to not use when we're talking about transhumanists, that I often hear Christian theologians suggest that transhumanism is inherently Pelagian, right? Because there's this salvific state that they think they can achieve through technological advancement and whatnot. And I want to say, yes, it can get unpacked in that way, where they think, oh, look, so if I'm a Christian, it's like, oh, look, there's this resurrected state out there. It sounds cool. Let's try to do it now. And I can achieve this thing that I'm supposed to receive as a gift of grace. And then kind of have a Pelagian vision. The question that I want to ask, though, is does it have to get unpacked that way, right? Is it entirely possible to say that, yes, there is this eschatological state that I will only receive as a gift of grace, but also say that that casts a vision for how we should live now in light of that eschatological reality, using the gifts and resources that God has given us, so that I am working toward this vision of the eschaton, not because I think I can achieve it, I know I have to receive it as a gift of grace at the end of the day, but because I think it can inform the way that I use resources now. So I have no problem with the idea of trying to work out this transformative vision, not in a Pelagian sense, but in a sense of anticipating that which will eventually come as gift. And in that sense, it actually works out a lot the way that many of us think of sanctification. Right? We don't think of sanctification as something that we achieve through our efforts. It's a gift of grace. But we think that because we think that there is this goal of sanctification that we will receive as a gift of grace, we should live in light of that. And so there are things that we should be doing, not in a Pelagian kind of work it out for yourself kind of way, but in a working toward the gift kind of way. Mm-hmm. And if I worked out transhumanism that way, I don't know, it sounds different.
It's an interesting point. Well, let's open it up to discussion questions from the floor. Microphone's right there, so come on up and make a line.
Thank you for that really engaging talk. Since you opened with Flannery O'Connor, an exhortation to engage with her writing, can you speak briefly? I would love to hear you talk briefly about your engagement with her on this issue. Do you find in her literature or in her letters a robust doctrine or picture of the necessity of the soul? Or is it more that the necessity of the body and the selfness contained in the body that you're resisting in posthumanism?
Well, it's both. I mean, I started down this research trajectory because of Flannery O'Connor. I found that everything that she was writing was speaking against this kind of Gnostic dualism that had become not only a part of American intellectual life via Emerson and people like that, but also a part of the church. And she thought it was a bad infection of the church. And so she was always writing stories that would draw the characters through their bodies through some greater spiritual understanding that could not be gotten any other way. And she's very Thomistic, but not the Thomas that people think Thomas is when he's a dualist. No, the other Thomas, the real Thomas, right? The one that's not that way. Because she thought that that was essential to, a person understanding who they really are. They have to be kind of drawn back through their bodily weakness and frailty to say, I've been made by God for some other purpose. So that's where it all started for me. I would talk more about that, but, you know, you wouldn't get me to stop.
I'm interested, maybe nobody else is, but I'm interested in the idea of body and soul, the implications that that has for relatedness or individuality. I have a 5-year-old granddaughter who, apart from gender, is almost a carbon copy of her father. And so we know where that came from. just as our DNA is passed on, is the soul, do the fathers consider the soul to be unique and individual? Is there a relatedness with the soul that that we could see sort of like there is with the body? And what implications does that have then for us as body of Christ and bride of Christ?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know enough about the church fathers per se to talk about how specifically they thought about the individuation of each soul, right? The part of the conversation we had yesterday where we were talking about person and how has the word person changed through the years and how is it different from what the church fathers meant by that is related to what you're asking about, you know? And I just don't know enough, maybe Mark can to answer that particular question. Do you have,
Yeah, so in most, there are different ways of understanding body-soul relationships in the early church, but in almost all of them, the soul is the individuating principle.
Yeah.
So the soul is that which makes you a unique particular, as opposed to like our bodies share an awful lot in common and whatnot, but the soul is the individuating piece there. The one thing that I want to follow up on, kind of where I think we might mess up a little bit on if we emphasize the intermediate state too much, right? Because there you have disembodied souls kind of hanging out together. And a lot of times our language of reunion with lost family members and whatnot really emphasizes the relationality of the intermediate state. And I actually want to kind of grab onto where the early church went to with the body a lot of times is the body is that which makes me accessible to other people.
Yes,
so the body is a fundamentally relational concept. It's how we interact with one another and makes us available to each other. And so I want to actually downplay some of this like robust community that we experience in the intermediate state. Maybe some of that is there, but I want that to also be like really limited and only like a partial anticipation so that part of the resurrection of the body is returning us to the relatedness and the availability that was the vision from the beginning.
Yeah, I want to add to that the importance of the other that comes with that, that you have a differentiated body from the other. And I thought of when you were asking your question, cloning, and the crazy argument that somehow if you cloned somebody that would be the same person. I mean, that's just insane, right? For these reasons. If you have a soul and that individuates you from somebody else, having this exact same brain or even twins, exact same DNA, whatever, they're not going to be the same person. And there's a reason for that.
So a lot of these conversations get at this language of playing God in the world, right? And if I understood Mark earlier, he was sort of saying that, in a certain sense, as the church, as Jesus's hands and feet in the world, that's exactly what we should be doing, right? Playing God in a certain sense. So I guess my question is maybe to tease that out a little bit more. How do we, in these questions of bioethics, how do we understand when we are playing God in the right sense? And how do we understand when we are trying to supplant and push out the creator and sort of be the creator ourselves?
I get asked that question all the time. And it is not an easy question to answer, right? Because you never want to say, oh, you know, human beings should never try to control nature, right? I mean, we do that all the time. That's what doctors do, right? They're trying to heal some disease that are in people. I just think that there is a difference between therapy and enhancement, and it is an incredibly hard line to draw, right? And the other thing, you remember I said that the language of the soul came out of the seminar that I led? The other thing that came out of the seminar was there is a line between a therapy and enhancement, and just because it's really difficult to draw doesn't mean there isn't one, right? And I've always come back to that and thinking, you know, Dan Trier, that was one of his thoughts, is that, yes, because it means something to say, when this person had a car accident, they had a disfigured face, and we wanted to fix her face with plastic surgery. That's different from the plastic surgeries that Cher has had, right? That there's fundamentally something different about that. That you've crossed over a kind of a boundary there, and that doesn't make that an easy question to answer. Okay.
To some extent, this is why I've been kind of noodling yesterday and today on the whole, what does it mean to be human? Because that's when we talk about these kinds of parameters and distinctions between therapy and enhancement, Christians generally try to kind of resource, there is something that it means to be human, and playing God inappropriately is to go beyond that. Mm-hmm. The problem is with the word something.
Yes.
That we're kind of wrestling with this whole conversation because we don't have a particularly clear way of answering that question. And it's where I find the post-humanist conversation so valuable, is because they're pushing us to recognize that there's a softness in our language that makes it very difficult for us to handle these issues.
Let me add, if you want to read something really good about this, Martha Nussbaum has an essay called Transcending Humanity, and I think she's dead right in that.
You think Martha Nussbaum's right on something?
I like Martha Nussbaum.
Oh, okay.
What made you think I don't like
her? I'm not a big fan. But I think I want to disagree that the post-humanist conversation is so helpful, because I think it gets us... I think we may do better to stick closer to the ground, to particular problems that arise. For instance, not all enhancement is bad. Vaccines are enhancement, and they're often very good. So I think rather than worrying about the biggest question that the transhumanists raise, we should worry about particular issues connected with making your children better in certain ways, and whether that's okay. Medicating someone who doesn't have a recognizable emotional disorder but is just shy. Should we medicate them to make them more outgoing? So I think we'll get farther if we think about those things, which are happening all the time around us, than if we try to answer the biggest question. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof, I think.
Yeah, and I think all I want to say, I guess I can't say I completely agree. I agree to an extent. I guess I do find the post-humanist conversation valuable for two reasons. One, I think it's pressing us to have conversations about issues that aren't that far away. In many of these conversations, we as Christians have tended to be a generation or two behind the conversation. Technology is moving quickly enough that I think asking broader scale questions is valuable. The other thing that I worry a little bit, and this could be just my limited experience with people who are engaging those kinds of decisions, I think because they're not asking some of these bigger questions, the way that they're making decisions in the particular instances is reflective of not sufficiently well thought out theological understandings of the person and what it means to flourish as humans. And they're a little bit more knee-jerk-y. And I know they don't have to be, but at least for me, this conversation has forced me to think a little bit more broadly.
Hi, so I have two questions. You can take a crack at both or pick one. The first, so you mentioned during your talk that you have some concerns about the connotations around the word spirit. Regardless of whether or not we use spirit language, I'm interested in what you think about sort of the tripartite anatomy of personhood. You know, a lot of Christians are trichotomists. They draw a distinction between soul and spirit. And I'm wondering how that would affect your take on this. And secondly, one of the points that came to bear in the video that we watched is this whole idea of the scientist is the new shaman. And there are a lot of transhumanist movements that are taking on sort of a quasi-religious kind of sensibility. And you have people like Kurzweil saying, through technology, we're going to become the gods we once worshipped. You know, you actually have a transhumanist church in Florida now and conversations about AI gods and all sorts of other science fiction craziness. So I'm just interested in how you see that shaping out. Do you see that as becoming a widespread movement? And if so, how do we respond?
Well, just briefly on the first point, I don't want to divide the person up into spirit, soul, body. What, you know, the reason why I want to keep the word soul is so that if it can contain the concept of those two together and, you know, inseparable, precisely because the language of spirit is being co-opted by Oprah et al, you know, for this kind of vague something that we all have in common that we're going to call love, and we're going to, you know, kind of ascend to that in a kind of, I don't know, post-millennial transhumanist kind of way, you know. And I think that maybe, I don't know enough about the Christian transhumanist organization, but they must conceive of themselves as really post-millennial, right? Like, we are really bringing the church here this way. We are deifying, you know, ourselves. And I have never liked the Eastern Orthodox kind of way of putting the development of the human person as the deification. I've never liked that. Because it plays into this kind of transhumanist problem of thinking that we're supposed to be gods instead of, you know, be creatures made in the image of God who have a perfected reflection of that, representation of that as different parts of this God, right? So that's how I would answer that question.
Did y'all catch the part where Eastern Orthodoxy is responsible for transhumanism? We all got that? Okay.
This is why I don't like Q&A. Actually, I do like it, but hey.
I'll give you a different track of honor.
I wanted to take some of the pressure off of Esau from yesterday, so.
Okay. Yeah, eliminate motherhood.
So I think you've done a really good job of showing what's at stake in losing the language of soul. And this is probably more of a question for me. I'm not saying you'd have failed to do this, but as I listened, I was also searching for where does the account of the brain, kind of the emergent properties having then the self merging out of it, where does that run aground on their own, using their own empiricism? Are there things to point to? Because, you know, show the clip of the God helmet, right? Yeah. There's one trying to explain, here's how you have these mystical experiences. Are there things using the empirical worldview that they work in that we can point to and say, well, that's where this idea of the brain being everything runs aground? Are there things to point to? So I'm just asking you, what would you point
to
say it's insufficient? You need the soul language that I'm using.
Yeah, you know, this is a big and complex question because neuroscience is a big and complex field right now that's growing. And I always feel like I want to have Bill Struthers along with me everywhere I go. So I could say, Bill, will you answer that question? He's a neuroscientist, you know, who works at Wheaton and has done research in this area. And it is fascinating stuff. And I read a lot of it because it's really, really interesting. Science of reading, science of, you know, what happens in your brain when you do this. What I will say just briefly in answer to that question is, what we have to be aware of as cultural consumers of science, and science reporting is one of my top 10 hate things. I hate science reporting. But they often do this kind of thing that, oh, the fMRI machine, right? It lit up, these areas of your brain lit up when this happened. So therefore, and they make these ridiculous conclusions just about some brain patterns on an fMRI machine, okay? So in other words, what I'm trying to say is neuroscience is really crude right now, and don't let it be more than that. And when you hear these results about somebody's brain lighting up a certain way, and that's part of the reason why I put that person your helmet thing up there. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Good morning. Other than Flannery O'Connor, who in either popular culture, movies, music, books, short stories are asking the questions and sort of poking this idea of a totally scientific materialist future? I don't know. I'm thinking of, for example, the Blade Runner movies. Who is asking those, what are some of the material asking those smart questions?
Well, thank you for giving me my chance to plug my book. I wrote a book on that, and in that book I describe all these different texts, primarily American fiction, that deals with those issues, like, well, Margaret Atwood is Canadian, but North American. Oryx and Crake deals with that. There's a lot of American novels that do. And then, of course, a whole host of other movies that are not something that you can sort of simply take one way or the other, but a lot of times end up being read simplistically by our culture. So there's a lot of answers to that. And I can't sit and name them, but they're in my book, though.
Can I plug one book as well? Not mine, so I'm not like Christina. I'm not trying to sell my books. But I mean, this
I would never do such a thing.
No. this is short of the transhumanist, but it's a transhumanist issue. But just in terms of the general improvement of our humanity, I really think that the one of the volumes that the President's Council on Bioethics produced, that's titled Beyond Therapy, and which is in print, you can buy. It's not a theological document, but if you want to think about some of these issues, it is really a useful place to turn.
And there's an anthology they produce called Being Human that also has fictional texts in it that engage with this issue. The anthology. That's a good one.
And I'll say, I spend a lot of time reading science fiction. That at the popular level, that's where a lot of these ideas mm-hmm. get teased out in helpful and unhelpful ways. But if you want to get a feel for the way that just kind of the way these ideas are circulating at the popular level, science fiction literature is just outstanding for that. Oh yeah, a lot on TV. So, Altered Carbon, the Battlestar Galactica. I'm trying to think. There's, I just lost it. Yeah, they do a lot in science fiction with the kind of computerized intelligence and AI. And there's one. It's going to come to me probably in like 5 minutes if you come back to me. There's one series in particular that's been super. No.
Oryx and Crake is a great novel. I think people should read Oryx and Crake. And it's speculative fiction, sci-fi, whatever. There's tons.
Well, that's all we have time for. So, join me in giving thanks to our panelists.